You're listening to the Full and Thriving Podcast, a place where courageous women come to break free from food obsession, heal their relationship with their body, and strive to live a life that's present, lighthearted, and meaningful. If you're listening, my wish is that this podcast serves as a catalyst that inspires you to nourish your body, nurture your mind, and energize your spirit. I'm your host, Meg McCabe, a certified life coach and eating disorder recovery coach with a PhD in having a good time. Just kidding about that last part. Anyway, thank you so much for listening and enjoy the show. Do you ever feel like typical treatment for eating disorders feels oversimplified or a little too black and white for your recovery journey? Do you ever wonder why the messaging you receive about food and nutrition from your treatment team looks so different from what you're hearing elsewhere? In today's episode, I chat with Dr. David Wyss, a registered dietitian who specializes in the treatment of eating disorders and substance abuse. He holds a doctorate in public health and is the founder of Wise Mind Nutrition. In this episode, we explore the importance of nuance and dialectical thinking in eating disorder recovery, and I promise this episode will get your mental wheels turning. Before I begin this episode, I want to share that Dr. Wyss has a unique perspective on recovery that is not typically shared by all in the space. For instance, he mentions the reality of food addiction in folks recovering from substance abuse. Because of the nature of his work and commitment to nuance, some of what he shares in this episode might be triggering or conflicting to the messages you hear in treatment. If you have difficulty with nuance or you feel easily triggered by outside nutritional messages, I recommend that you skip this episode or proceed with gentle caution. Dr. Wyss is first and foremost an eating disorder recovery professional, and I believe he does a good job acknowledging the thoughts and feelings that might come up for the listeners throughout this show. With that, I hope you enjoy this episode of Full and Thriving. Hi, Dr. Wyss. How are you today?
Life is good. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining me here. It is a true pleasure. I am so grateful that you could make it, and welcome to the show.
Yes, what a great show to be on. Thank you.
You're so welcome. I'm really excited to dive into our conversation today. Doing a little bit of a deep dive. You are definitely an independent thinker in this field, so I'm excited to learn from you.
Yeah, it's sometimes lonely when you develop new thought and, you know, looking for deep conversations. And I get the sense already that you're someone that I can have a deep conversation with.
That's why I became a podcaster. It's a great way to have deep conversations with amazing professionals in the space. So let's just dig on in. I'd love it if you could start off sharing a little bit about your own story of addiction and how that evolved into a career in nutrition.
Yes, everyone always wants to know the personal story, so I get to tell it a lot. And there's a lot of versions of it. I'm going to give you the very abridged one today. I do come from a legacy of alcoholism and addiction. My mother was a hippie and has some counterculture roots. And I think I picked up on some of that and always had an interest in being off the grid, being underground, counterculture. And so there was a lot of music and a lot of celebratory energy. I'm a product of the rave scene in the late 90s, which, you know, was a big part of, you know, who I came up as and my identity even today. But that culture definitely took a turn and it brought along some darkness after many years. I'm from West LA and I did excel academically and I ended up doing my undergrad at USC. And yeah, I crashed and burned during that time. And I had some difficulties that necessitated me to pause my life, take a really good look at my options and reconsider my trajectories. You know, One thing I always kind of giggle about is that when I was at USC as an undergrad, I took a nutrition class and I hated it. It was awful. It was like the worst experience ever. This was in the 90s, okay? And it was like, at that time, it was just a calorie-centric model. The class literally was, you know, you learning how to like track calories, and you got into these body chambers, and the assignment was like to, you know, set a goal and use nutrition to manipulate some of the variables. And I was so turned off by it, and I dropped out of that class. So I am a nutrition undergrad dropout that ended up circling back much later. But yeah, when I started my life over, I had some health challenges, mostly mental health challenges. And I just had a strong intuition. I had a strong intuition that there was some healing energy out there in the world and that I hadn't touched. And so I just became super curious about it. And no one told me. It wasn't like I had a nutritionist or a mentor that was like, this is going to be really important for you. I intuitively knew that there was a lot of foods that I had never really touched and a lot of foods that I was just mostly focused on. And so, yeah, for me, I got really interested in food as a source of recovery. And it turned out that it made a big difference for me. Like my skin changed, my eyes changed, you know, my energy changed and people noticed it, you know, and most importantly, my thinking changed. And now I want to preface this by saying, like, I was a very unhealthy person, right? Like, I would stay up for days at a time and have Marlboro Reds for breakfast and Mountain Dew and, you know, pharmaceutical pills that weren't prescribed. You understand? So I was ripe for improvement. You know what I mean? I was definitely like in a place where anything would be helpful. But I did find that food and exercise and spirituality and even just academic starting to learn again, it did rewire my brain. And I became a totally different person within a few months. And it was like very evident that I should do something about that. And I started helping people with wellness.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So it started off as, you know, you're noticing this change within yourself. And then you were inspired to start helping people kind of down a similar path. I know nutrition had an impact on your healing. Like you were starting with barely any nutrition, probably very poor health overall. Yes. So you're like, I want to get other people on this train. And then you went to dietitian school, even though you absolutely hated the class. And that's hilarious because I took one dietetics class in undergrad and it was terrible. I completely relate to that.
If I'm honest, I wouldn't say that I became like super excited about converting people, you know, and being like, I need to show others. It actually happened the other way around. I had such a rapid transformation that people were like, Dave, what's going on with you, man? Like, you're different, you know? And people asked me for help. And so I was like looking for work, you know? And so I did the classic path of like, where can I be helpful? And I became a personal trainer for a few years. And I was working with people that were in rehabs. You get it?
Yeah.
People that were like, had a similar path as me. People that got really messed up, had a lot of difficulties and were in tricky transitional periods in their lives. So it's like, yeah, I've always been into nutrition, but like, I'm really into recovery. I like seeing people that are down and out rise up. I like people with challenges in their life that hit low spots, get excited about a new chapter and be able to step into new energy with grace, whatever that looks like for them.
Mm-hmm. That is such a big difference, right? That distinction there is like, you're actually more excited about seeing that transformation, that full recovery process.
Yeah.
And so that is so fascinating. I feel like food was a part of it for you, but it wasn't everything, but the path laid itself out. People were asking you for help. I always find that interesting too, because I find when you have a purpose, the purpose will chase you down sometimes. Like you're not even trying to help people, people are asking you for help.
That's right. And so, yeah, the path started to become clear and I got into wellness and then finished my undergrad and pursued a master's degree. I did some research and it was like, what is the way to become a nutrition professional? And it was pretty clear that the registered dietitian nutritionist was the most recognized nutrition professional. And if you wanted to actually work in healthcare, that was the path to go down.
Okay. And at this point, were you clean from your drugs and your lifestyle before?
Yes. I started my life over in 2006, September, actually. So.
So coming up on that anniversary. Yeah. Congrats.
17 years later. Let's go.
Yeah. All right. So it sounds like from your story that when you got to dietitian school, you realized there was so much like toxicity there. And I'm curious about that.
Yeah, I've been speaking about that a bit lately. I think one of the things that I noticed really early on was that there was a lot of contention and debate and disagreement in the nutrition space. Mm-hmm. And one of the kind of strange cultures that I picked up on in the dietitian world was that there seemed to be like some anger or upset toward other practitioners and other professionals. And I always thought it was weird. Like the dietitians are mad at the chiropractor, they're mad at the acupuncturist, they're mad at the trainer. And there was this kind of ethos of like, we're the experts. We're the only one who knows the truth. And these other people don't know the truth. They're spreading misinformation. And while, of course, we all know that nutrition world is just filled with misinformation, I was smart enough to know that like, that can't actually be the reality, that there's one professional that is the truth and everyone else is just totally misguided. And so I always had this curious, open mind, like, why is it that there's so much debate? What are the hidden agendas that are going on here, right? Who's profiting off of all of this? And I just had a lot of questions that other people didn't seem to have.
Yeah, I could totally see that, how there is that energy in the space of sometimes people are going to position themselves as the experts, and then there's no more room for expertise elsewhere.
Correct. Correct. And I got very curious about that. And it was like, you know, one of the things I saw pretty early on is that once, you know, the dietitian gets into their internship, and I worked in a hospital, you know, I worked in a school district, I worked in a WIC clinic, community nutrition, I did all these different things. The job itself wasn't as exalted as it was kind of painted out to be. In school, they're like, yo, you're the expert. You are the person with the white coat. Like, you make the decisions. And then when I got to the hospital, it was like the nurse didn't even want to look at me. My job was just like, give them a boost, write down what percentage they ate, you know, and there was very little respect for the dietitian. And I became very curious about that. What's going on here?
And why do you think that was?
The conclusion that I came to was that, and I want to be sensitive because I'm proud to be a dietitian. And I've like written some articles that I think some people perceive as like anti-dietitian. But my genuine hope is to like elevate, you know, the credential and like get people to wake up, stop fighting amongst each other, right? Like, let's see the big picture, right? Let's pursue multiple truths rather than this singular truth, right? But what I did see, and a lot of my colleagues saw it as well, was that there was some pretty deep ties between my parent organization, the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, and food companies. In other words, there was a lot of, you know, the multinational billion-dollar food corporations, you know, the Krafts and the Coca-Colas and the beef councils and all of that seemed to be very influential in the education that we were receiving. And it caught my attention. It caught my attention. I don't know. Maybe it's because I was like in the world of drugs and crime for a little bit that my antenna was like, wait a minute, this is shady. Who's on the take? But like other people didn't seem to care. I cared and I started asking questions about it. And when I started asking questions, I noticed that there was still like, there was some energy of like, no, you're not allowed to talk about that here. And then I was like, well, wait a minute, what's going on here? So yeah, there was a group of us early on that were like a little bit suspicious. And it wasn't because we wanted to burn the house down. We wanted the public to trust us more. And so that's what I learned, is that a lot of the general public had some mistrust of dietitians because it seemed like they were promoting the agenda of the food industry rather than promoting, you know, public health. And that caught my attention. But then, of course, when you look at people that are promoting public health and they're fear-mongering around food and they're just telling you nothing's safe, everything's a problem, like that looks terrible too, right? So there was this dichotomy created where it seemed like there was groups of professionals that were saying, the food's safe. There's nothing wrong with the food. Just eat it. Don't worry about it. And then you have other people that are saying like, no, this is not safe. You need to be concerned about these kinds of foods. And it was another moment in time when I was like, it can't be that one group is true and the other is not. There has to be some really interesting gray area intersection spaces here. And that's what I've always been interested in, is looking at the shades of gray, the intersections, the areas of convergence and divergence. And it does seem like a lot of people in the nutrition space are very susceptible to black and white thinking, binary thinking, like this is the truth and this is not. This is diet culture and this is non-diet culture, right? You have two choices. And there's never two choices. There's very rarely two choices, right? There's always a whole world of nuance and all of that. So I kind of dedicated my career to like helping people think in more nuanced ways, to not decide that this is what's true and this is not. Like science, I have a PhD, so I had the opportunity to really take a deep dive into the study of truth, right? Dialectics, the understanding of, you know, different conceptual models and how different people see them from different perspectives and what is their underlying theoretical orientation that drives their thinking, right? And it really just blew my mind open. And I saw there was a deep need for people in the nutrition space to start thinking this way, and particularly in the eating disorder world.
Very interesting. There's so much you just shared there, like the healthy skepticism of the food industry, the importance of dialectical thinking and finding the nuance. I'm really curious, before we dive deeper, what exactly is dialectical thinking for those who might not know? And why do you feel like this is important?
Yes, thank you. So I think there's a lot of potential definitions. And one broad one is like the art of investigating truths, like dialectics. Okay, but it got popular in DBT, which is dialectical behavioral therapy, a very like emerging modality of mental health treatment. And I think that, you know, one of the easy ways that people understand it is to think about these two different kind of parts of the mind, right? The logical part of the mind, right? That's very focused on tasks and rational. And then we have the emotional part of the mind that's very mood dependent, more hot, right? More volatile. And then at the intersection is the wise mind. Right. So in essence, dialectical thinking is an effort to always have a non-dual awareness, to be able to think of things as a both and rather than an either or. And this is very difficult for people, especially nowadays in the political climate. I think we are like almost prescribed to like pick a side on an issue. Right. And so when it comes to like, you know, larger issues, there comes a time when you got to like pick a side. But when it comes to science and health, especially mental health, it's all this really sticky, confusing, different stuff where sometimes picking a side and sticking your flag in the ground on an issue, especially in science, is really dangerous.
It's so interesting because I'm relating to this on a individual level, just with eating disorder recovery. You know, as a coach, I'm constantly telling people, you got to live in the gray zone. You got to set goals within the gray zone. Like, we can't be black and white, even in the small actions, you know, all the time. And so it's interesting how you're taking this like pretty huge fundamental piece of recovery and applying it to the mindset of the field.
This is my big argument, is like, as an eating disorder professional, one of my biggest goals is to help people minimize black and white thinking, right? To eradicate all or nothing thinking, right? Around food and around body. But then like, as someone that's been in the field for so long, the eating disorder professionals have very black and white thinking about what's true and what's not. And so when I've made that point, some people are like, wow, right? That's a really, really good point. That's hard to argue against, right? That we're all susceptible to black and white thinking. We're all susceptible to bias, and we all have our own biases.
Well, it's really interesting because I feel like sometimes the eating disorder doesn't leave room for nuance. So as a professional, we're scared to leave nuance there because we don't want the eating disorder to kind of sink its teeth in and run in a direction we didn't want it to go into, right? And so I'm really curious if you could explain more about this polarization and maybe give some examples of how the nutrition space is polarized and maybe how this might impact folks with eating disorders.
Absolutely. And I want to say that your point is so well received that a lot of eating disorder thinking is quite extreme. And so in order to have a viable solution, it kind of has to be extreme in some cases, right?
Right.
You have to have a really strong, I tell my clients, like if you've had these really, you know, restrictive, food negative, food punitive thinking patterns for 10 years every day, you might have to listen to a podcast every day and do an affirmation in the morning and read 50 books before your brain is starting to like unravel from some of that, right? So we do need very clear messaging for a lot of people that are susceptible to extremes. But I will say two things and then come back to your question. One, extremes tend to lead to other extremes.
True.
And extremes usually don't end well, right? Even like addiction recovery, like the addiction recovery thing, a lot of people look at that as like really extreme when someone gets sober from drugs and alcohol and now all they do is go to meetings every day and they talk about nothing other than recovery and they cut ties with everyone. Like that's extreme, but that was needed to recover from opioid addiction or meth addiction. Like you needed an extreme thing, right? But I always tell people sometimes we got to be sort of rigid to get free, but we don't get free so that we could stay rigid. At some point, you know, we have to come back to like gray areas and to the middle and start thinking about nuance, right? In order for recovery to be sustainable. And this is true for addictions as well as eating disorders, right? Like there might be a difference between the message that someone gets at 30 days into residential versus 30 months out in an outpatient setting, right? Is the message the exact same? Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I want to make one other point and then I'll answer your question. I think we do a great disservice when we lump all eating disorders into one category. I think that's like the perfect example of needing more nuance. You know, for example, you know, the individual with anorexia nervosa, restrictive type that has a history of OCD, that has orthorexic tendencies, that's very perfectionistic, right? Is a very different phenotype than, let's say, the person with bulimia nervosa that had a lot of trauma and that learned how to purge to self-soothe their PTSD. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, well, that is so true in my experience as well. I approach help, you know, I'm a coach, so I'm supporting a team outpatient in an outpatient way. I approach those clients very differently. And there's got to be like, there's even very clear personality distinctions in a general sense that you're navigating from one diagnosis to the next.
And then, of course, binge eating disorder, which has a whole different world of possibilities that can depart even more from some of those other presentations. And so, yeah, I think that any clinician or practitioner or coach knows that there's a lot of heterogeneity with eating disorders, but we still talk about them as if it's one thing. Like we still use the term eating disorders and say, well, in eating disorders, we do this, right? And if you have an eating disorder certification, this is what you do, right? As opposed to thinking about it as this like really broad range of possibilities that intersects with other mental health diagnoses, right? That requires a lot of thinking and a lot of nuance. So to think about like one perfect example of the need for dialectical thinking, when I started my company, Nutrition and Recovery, 2012, became a dietitian, 2013, I was already in practice. I ran a lot of groups. I have a team of dietitians. We run groups at treatment centers. We bring eating disorder informed care into substance use disorder, mental health facilities. But I learned a lot about the groups there, you know, and the people, who they are as an eater, what their needs are, and what might some of the messaging be that would be most beneficial, right? Mm. And this is, you know, where it gets tricky. And I know sometimes people have a hard time wrapping their head around this, but, you know, for example, there could be a group of people in there that were similar to me and had very poor health behaviors and just drink energy drinks all day long and eat convenience food from gas stations and fast food, never really been to a grocery store, right? Don't know how to cook and probably eat, you know, 7 or 8 grams of fiber per day, get like no polyphenols, no antioxidants, no real colors, right? It's just like, you know, wheat, meat, and cheese, okay? And like their gut environment's probably compromised, and it probably has some pretty significant downstream effects on their mental health, including depression and anxiety, right? Mm. So like to teach people how to improve their mental health recovery in that setting really might involve an emphasis on gut health, anti-inflammatory eating, eating more fiber, thinking about protein as being important for, you know, neurotransmitter production. You might be like needing to actually promote health. Whereas if you are in an eating disorder treatment center where there's a lot of people that have been obsessed with health and have orthorexic tendencies, right? They might even know more about nutrition than me, right? Like you would need to cover very different topics, right? So like, it's almost unsafe to overly promote health, right? Because people right. take that
absolutely.
Too far, right? It's the promotion of health that people attach onto. And now they heard one thing about an oil that they should never eat, right? And they're committed to not eating that at all costs, right? So very, very dangerous environment for health education. Whereas mm-hmm. the other group, the other 5 or 6 people, that's exactly what they need.
Right.
They need the health education. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Well, now you have like these polar sort of opposite type of groups, right? So bear with me, right? This yeah. is coming. Someone's done this for years. I got to run this group over here. This is the anti-diet group that we're running over here. And this is like, get your shit together and start eating better group over here. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so, okay, they're very different. But what if someone has both an eating disorder and a substance use disorder? And they have a combination of these things going on at the same time. Now what, right? What do you do? What do you do if there's, you know, 3 people from that group and 3 people from that group and they're all in the same room, right? Like, how can you be helpful to people, right? And so that's what really gave birth to me starting to think that it can't be eating disorder binary, eating disorder yes or no. That in the substance use disorder group, there's probably some people that have a little diet culture energy somewhere. They've been on a diet. They have some body image noise. Maybe they started using stimulants for weight loss, right? And you start to see like, oh, that phenomenon exists a little bit over here. And then you learn that this phenomenon exists over here, right? And that everything is coming together in this infinite world of possibilities rather than this is your diagnosis. And this is your diagnosis. It's like they're all sort of overlapping in ways that require and necessitate very scientific thinking and very gentle messaging and very much individualized treatment. And so, yeah, I became just fascinated with the idea of nuance. I'll give you one other example. There's a lot of research now showing that high fiber, anti-inflammatory eating, Mediterranean style diets are beneficial for depression. 7 randomized controlled trials to date, okay? There's like a growing body of evidence to show that Mediterranean-style eating with the right kinds of fats and good, colorful fruits and vegetables are helpful for people with depressive symptoms globally, okay? And a lot of this research comes from Australia, the UK, Canada, right? And we know that let's take someone who has some diet culture energy they picked up from their parents, and they've been trying to diet for a long time and have been unsuccessful. They've weight cycled. They're committed to a certain weight, right? To promote something like the Mediterranean diet to that person, it wouldn't make sense, right? Because
mm-hmm.
what you mm-hmm. want to do is get them off of the diet train, right?
Yeah.
To stop
yeah.
thinking about a perfect way of eating, to normalize food, to normalize their relationship with their body, and just let go a little bit and loosen up, right? So right. Here's the question, and I don't have the answers. I'm just trying to get people's wheels spinning a little bit. What if you had someone that had that kind of an eating disorder, very restrictive in nature, but they also had really persistent depression that wasn't responding well to the SSRIs? You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Mm-hmm. And like they've done TMS, they've done ketamine, they've done a lot of things, and like their depression is just not resolving, right? The question is, and I promise you, I'm not saying I have the answer, would there be a way to honor someone's eating disorder recovery and be non-diet, non-math centric, but also to promote or support, maybe is a better word, a way of eating that would be anti-inflammatory and support their mental health? Is it possible? Is it even possible, right?
Yeah. It's like it's a big mind effing situation to dive into the nuances of that.
Yeah.
Especially if there is a raging eating disorder and a temperament that likes to cling on to a diet and run with it to an extreme way.
That's right.
I was trying to explain this to my partner today. Like, you know, it's really like scary to venture into nuance sometimes because of the temperament of people with eating disorders. It can turn into an extreme. But I like the idea, and it's a very hopeful way of thinking, which is there a way we can blend all the needs together and be supportive of that person's recovery in that moment? And, you know, when you phrase it, I do think it's possible. Like I want to think that something like that is possible. But then there is a little part of me that's saying, are we putting a little too much power into the food?
Perfect. So for one person, their problem is putting too much power into the food, and their treatment would be that they need to put less emphasis on the food, right? Mm-hmm. But for the next person, the food actually could be quite profound for them, mm-hmm. right? And that's where I think the field has done a terrible job discerning, right? There are some people that food is just kind of symbolic of calories. And I think that's mm-hmm. one of the kind of age-old messages, like, you know, a calorie is a calorie. Doesn't matter. If you don't want to eat this calorie, exchange it for something else. It's just a calorie. It doesn't matter. And I think that that could be true for one person. But for the next person, maybe because of their genetics, maybe because of their microbiome, maybe because of their immune system, right? Maybe because of their hormones, maybe because of their culture, that the food lands differently and has more of an impact, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's just a way to acknowledge that food can be subtle and inert and just energy. Food is fuel for one person, but food can be profound for the next.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, it all comes back to that eating disorder, right? It's like for the person with anorexia, very restrictive, a calorie is a calorie because we want them to eat, right? Oh. And like re-nourish and actually have energy in their body. Where perhaps for another individual, we can start bringing more nuance into that.
Yeah, and I think the way to do it as providers and professionals is not to be like, oh, this is what I think you should do, but just listen to what their body's saying and be curious mm-hmm. about it, and not always endorse it or challenge it, but just continue to like collect data, right? If a person mm-hmm. that has a lot of PTSD, they've been through a lot of abuse, a lot of relational rupture, right? They're having a really hard time connecting to people and they're having some gut issues, right? There's going to be a time when their gut issues are mostly in their head, as Western medicine mm-hmm. would call it, or a relic of their eating disorder, as some people would call it. And there's going to be times when their gut issues are actually a biological result of their trauma and their unresolved stuff, and they are actually happening. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I just don't think people are able to know. So, you know, I've worked with a lot of eating disorder clients and patients over the years that have been traumatized from eating disorder treatment, from just having people like be the expert on them. This is what you have. This is your diagnosis. This is what's true for you. This is what you have to do, mm-hmm. right? As opposed to just like a humble curiosity about folks. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I want to learn more. What is your body saying? And is there a difference between what your mind is thinking and your body saying? Is there a discrepancy between the two? and really learning, you know, as opposed to always teaching.
Yeah. It's funny because the way you mentioned how folks have been traumatized by treatment centers and how people become the expert on them and what they need and what they should do. And it's almost like the origins of so many folks eating disorders being repeated, which is disowning yourself.
That's right. That's right. And the biggest example that I can think about is the super controversial topic of food addiction, right? Which, you know, a lot of people that have substance use disorder histories can cross addict. There's just a lot of data there. And there's been a lot of people that go into eating disorder treatment and are basically screaming. They're saying like, too much of this ultra processed food is overactivating my reward systems. And it's making me obsess about food all day. And then the clinical director, the lead dietitian tells them that that doesn't exist. It's all because of your dieting. This thing you're describing doesn't actually exist. And they're gaslighted, right? I've just dealt with a lot of people that have felt majorly unvalidated by people that don't have nuanced ways of thinking.
Yeah, that's interesting because my brain jumps to the famine response, right? So it's like when I think of like someone telling me they're addicted to food, my immediate thought is they're stuck in the binge restrict cycle.
That's the immediate thought of all eating disorder professionals. Immediate.
Right. And so can you explain more about that nuance? Because I'd like to learn about where you see food addiction actually happening versus, and how would someone know if they're actually authentically addicted to food versus if they are just part of the binge restrict cycle or the famine response and like their body is hijacking the situation because it needs nutrients for the next famine, right? Like, where is the difference?
Yes. And again, there's this incredible continuum of possibilities, right? On one end, we have the person who is entirely driven by restraint, has always had rules, avoided food, is weight suppressed, lives in a body that's smaller than perhaps quote unquote ideal, if we can even use that word. And they're perceiving a lot of food addiction symptoms, right? And they say, whenever I eat this, right? That's a perfect example of an unclear signal that's very noisy. It's very noisy by all the dieting, right? It's their weight suppression and their dieting that drives the perception of food addiction. And the food addiction is in fact not real, okay? And I think that that's what a lot of people who work in eating disorder treatment see the most of, right? They're perceiving food addiction or they're attaching to the construct of food addiction because they want a reason to not be able to eat those foods, right? And so that is something that we see clinically. Let's jump to the other extreme, right? The person who's never had an eating disorder. Perhaps they grew up in a home where the parents were fighting and eventually got divorced. A lot of trauma, low income, a lot of ultra-processed food. They've never gone on a diet. In fact, they don't even have that much body dissatisfaction. Maybe they wished they were in a smaller body, but they've gained weight over time. And now, let's say they end up going into a rehab at 30 years old, right? And now they're in rehab, no longer doing alcohol, meth, and they are smoking a pack of cigarettes a day, drinking coffee all day, and binge eating and night eating. And it's always ultra processed food. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so this is the other extreme example, the person that's never gone on a diet. Okay. Doesn't have any body image disturbance driving the restrained eating, but they have what would be considered obsession-like thinking around food, loss of control, right? Strong cravings, and essentially the overriding of willpower and the continued use despite negative consequences, right? Mm-hmm. So, and then we just have a world of possibilities in between, right? Where people have no addiction history. They just have food. Maybe they went through a divorce and they become emotional eaters. And there's now a lot of addiction-like eating. That's another term we use, reward-based eating, addiction-like eating, right? As opposed to food addiction, because it just has too much charge for some people. And some people use the term emotional eating. It just depends on how you slice it and dice it. If you're talking about neurobiology or if you're talking about emotions, you get it? People that study neuroscience use the term addiction because the neural pathways symbolize addiction very clearly, crystal clear, right? I'd say it's more like caffeine or nicotine addiction than heroin or cocaine. But yeah, it's a phenomenon that's been very well described in over 1,000 research papers over the last 17 years, right? The area that hasn't really made a lot of progress, and this is what I've worked on as an eating disorder dietitian, what do you do when there's both? Like, what's more important? What do you prioritize? And I think as someone that works in the field of eating disorders, the energy is always like eating disorder priority is first, because this is a life-threatening mental illness. And right, like this is the top of the list. And I stand by that, right? If someone has like, you know, restriction like eating, or they're purging, binging and purging in the cycle, right? Like that is the thing, okay? But I learned from my eating disorder colleagues that they believed that all presentations of food addiction are driven by dietary restraint, as you said, right? The natural assumption. But the question that was largely unanswered until recently, there was a great study published a few months ago that I'll cite in a minute. Is it possible that the food addiction is driving the dietary restraint?
Interesting.
Just something to think about. I'm not going to say I have the answers, and I'm not saying yes, but is it possible that some people diet too hard and then develop food addiction-like symptoms? Or let me not say or, let me say, and is it possible that people have addiction-like neurobiology and they have loss of control eating, and that's what drives them to go on their first diet? Does that make sense to you?
So yeah. I do see the reversal there.
The reversal.
What about the people listening who are just now confused about themselves and thinking, what if I'm addicted to food? What are your kind reminders to them?
Being addicted to food does not mean that you need to be abstinent, or that you need to go to a 12-step program, or that you need to be very deliberate about not eating these things. It might for a small subset of people, but if someone has body image noise and they have, if you have a long history of dieting, the solution is always making peace with food and making peace with your body, right? And that's going to look different from person to person. For one person, that could mean having something sweet at the end of every meal. For someone else, that could mean having a nice dessert every night. For someone else, that could be having it once a week. For someone else, it could be a couple times a month. Everyone's different, and it should change and evolve over time. You want to embrace the uncertainty of being an eater and embrace the evolution and accept the fact that your relationship to food will evolve over time. You know what I mean? And I can speak for me. When I was in rehabs and other institutions, I had crazy food addiction symptoms because I was getting sober off of drugs and alcohol. You know what I mean? But fast forward 17 years, I don't have any food addiction symptoms. So it's not a binary, like you either have this or you don't, right? It's kind of like depression or depressive symptoms. You could go through periods in your life where your depressive symptoms get really loud because of the circumstances of your life, right? And then you could go through lives when that's in remission, right? Periods in your life when that's in remission. And I think for people that are listening, it's important to know that if you are experiencing what feels like food addiction symptoms, it might be because you're so body dissatisfied and still committed to chasing after a weight goal. There's still something that's unresolved, right? It could be that you have a genetic predisposition to addiction like eating, and you're someone that could benefit from eating more fibrous and minimally processed foods. And I believe that, you know, there's going to be a lot of people that are like, that's me. That's me. That's what I want to do. And maybe, you know, maybe your team will help you. Maybe your coach will help you. Maybe your dietitian will help you. But at the end of the day, I really believe that there's a broader range of possibilities than we in the eating disorder field have been trained to think. And that's my only message. I don't want to push food addiction. I don't believe that that's an important thing that everyone needs to know about. But it is a construct that has been canceled in the eating disorder field. And the question you would ask is like, why is it canceled? Because it challenges some of the long-held dogmatic theories that exist, right? Like, you have to think about it. Like, why are people so upset? Why are people so angry at it, right? And they say, well, it promotes restriction. Okay, for some people it does. It also promotes freedom and recovery for other people. there's thousands of people out there in the world. Like, and I'm not a big 12-step food program guy. I see a lot of problems with it, but I would never poo-poo on it fully. There's thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people that have gotten recovery from those things. You know what I mean? Who am I to say, right, that they're poison or toxic, right? They might be poison or toxic for some people, but the perfect fit for someone else. So here's my answer to that question. Why are people so angry? Because it does challenge the established, you know, institutionalized eating disorder messaging around intuitive eating. It challenges it a little bit. It does. And it makes people really uncomfortable. All I'm saying is, instead of being uncomfortable and getting mad and fighting each other, let's talk about it. Let's have conferences about it. Let's sit at the round table. Let's bring in clients. Let's hear from our patients. Let's give them the microphone. Let's hear from people that have lived experience with all these things. Let's all come together and join forces rather than fighting each other while the big food companies just count their money and everyone else has rising eating disorder incidents, type 2 diabetes, depression, anxiety, and the list goes on and on. And we're left here fighting with each other online. Great. We're losing.
Oh my gosh, there's so much there. You know, I think it is really helpful to be reminded as an eating disorder professional that there are so many other cases and there's a spectrum of eating that we need to remember.
That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, because, you know, I'm speaking to people with eating disorders all day. And when I hear things that are outside of the general realm of recovery mentality, I get angry sometimes and I get frustrated because I'm protecting my clients.
Correct.
Right? Like, there's a part of me that gets very protective. Like, I want the people who need to hear the message to get the right message.
Be careful.
And
Be careful. I'm with you. I'm 100%.
And so I think that's why there is a little controversy around this conversation. And as a podcast host, when I, you know, heard that you were coming onto my podcast and I did a little bit of research, I remembered, I was like, oh man, this can stir the pot a little bit, but
little bit.
I think it's really important to have the conversation.
Yeah.
You know, and we need to have more voices at the table when it comes to healing in general and mental health. So
yeah.
I appreciate this.
Yeah, I do too. And I am a huge advocate for people with eating disorders. That is my job. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I do think that there's forgotten groups. There's missed groups.
Yeah.
And that's all. As someone that represents a marginalized group, people with addictions, right? I just want to say that anyone that has an addiction, whether it be a substance use disorder or an ultra processed food addiction, alcohol, whatever it is, a lot of those people feel marginalized by the eating disorder community.
Interesting. So what advice do you have for someone who's kind of confused by all the mixed messages that they're getting out there?
I think the best advice is to not dig your heels too deep in any one thing and just stay curious, right? And there's a difference between like truth at the population level and what feels like truth at the individual level, right? But like, for example, public health research might say that sugar is harmful for your health. But for an individual, including sugar in your diet on a regular and consistent basis might be the best thing that you could do for your health, right? So you have to be able to discern between messaging that's out there in the world and messaging that's true for you. And then you also have to remember that what might be true for your other friend in recovery might not necessarily be true for you. There might be someone that has some other nuance that they require, right? There might be someone that has three meals and three snacks, and there might be someone that has three meals and no snacks. And like, they can both work, you know what I mean? Depending on the person, depending on all those things. And I think the real thing is that when we're fighting amongst ourselves and comparing ourselves to other people, right? And then professionals are fighting, we're not able to make real progress because we're in a fight or flight state, rather than a calm, let's heal together state. Let's welcome diversity, body diversity, neurochemical diversity, neurodiversity. Let's just welcome all the different realms of possibilities and not be triggered by other people, right? When we feel safe, this is my healing work, 17 years separated from drugs, incarceration, you name it. I feel safe. When I feel safe, I don't feel triggered by anyone. You get it? Like,
yeah, so true.
I'm not triggered by messaging out there. You know, when I hear people say things, I say things like, oh, that makes sense. That makes sense why they might think that way. Mm-hmm. Oh, I understand that they have that background and that training. And I know that a lot of the listeners now are people in recovery. And I think, you know, if anything, I really just want to broaden your perspective, right? Like, this is about you, okay? But there is a collective consciousness out there in the world. And when we can interact with that in meaningful ways, we can experience peace. And, you know, I'm a non-diet dietitian, but I'm not an anti-diet dietitian. And what I mean by that is I'm not anti anything. I'm not setting up my life about what I'm against. I'm setting it up about what I'm for. And I am for recovery. I am for nuance. I am for making peace with food, making peace with body, learning how to cook, going to the grocery store, connecting to food at a spiritual level, mindful eating, soulful eating, intuitive eating, functional medicine. I'm into all these different things and bringing them together. And I think at the clinical level, the reason why I have so many different backgrounds and trainings and skills, it's not because there's so many different people that need to fall into these different buckets. It's because there's so many people that live at the intersection of all the buckets.
Yeah, yeah. It's so true. I appreciate the intersectionality of your work and the open-mindedness of what you're doing and what you're teaching. I think it's important for everyone to be open-minded and to, you know, pay attention to other folks out in the world outside of what they're used to communicating with every day. Okay, so before I let you go, David, I would love to hear where listeners could connect with you, work with you, if your message is something that's connected with them today.
Sure. My clinical practice is called Nutrition and Recovery. NutritionandRecovery.com has been around a long time. And I work with complex cases at this intersection space, right? That's what I do. People that have had negative experiences elsewhere, that have addiction, eating disorder, depression, anxiety. That's my sort of lane. I have an app that I built called Wise Mind Nutrition, and it is nutrition for mental health. So it's trying to go broader than just thinking in terms of eating disorders, which is a big part of what I do clinically, and say, what about the person with depression? What about the person with anxiety? What about the person with trauma? What about the person with ADHD? We have evidence about certain things that they could do, and these people matter too. It's a very non-diet program. There's a food log, so I'm trying to compete with Recovery Record. That's the Recovery Record thing going. No calories, no macronutrients, all qualitative, gentle nutrition. You know, you think about food groups, hunger, fullness, super warm energy, very supportive, allows people to set their own intentions, create their own path. Look at, you know, their day each night and reflect, bring in a little spirituality if that's something that floats someone's boat. And then there's, you know, like a video programming that has some cooking instructions, very non-diet, meditation. And we teach about the Nutrition for Mental Health Revolution. So it is designed by an eating disorder professional to be eating disorder friendly, but it's not an exclusive eating disorder app, if that makes sense.
It's designed that makes sense.
Anyone on a health and wellness journey, people with substance use disorders, but it is a very safe place for people to heal. And it's free. The food log's free. There's a free 9-day program. If someone wants to do the full Nutrition for Mental Health program, there's an upgrade, and you could provide some data if you'd like, so you can get some personalized messaging for various sort of mental health conditions. And you can see how your mental health improves over time. So you could see by food logging and staying accountable, you could see how eating disorder symptoms or anxiety symptoms might go down. And like Recovery Record, you'll be able to connect it to a clinician or a coach. And it's, yeah, it's a really awesome movement that I spent 2.5 years working on that I just released about a week or two ago. So yeah, soft launch and on Apple right now. And I'm sure by the time this comes out, it'll be on Google Android as well. And so, yeah, I have social media for Wise Mind Nutrition on TikTok, wise_mind_nutrition on Instagram, Wise Mind Nutrition, YouTube. And I also have a personal Instagram at Dr. David Wyss. Kind of transitioned to posting more about my life, my wife, my child, and some of the other stuff there, and spreading the good news about nutrition for mental health at Wise Mind Nutrition.
Fabulous. Thank you for all of that information. I think those will be helpful resources for many of the listeners. So Dr. Wyss, it has been a lovely conversation. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
You got it. I had such a pleasure chatting with you and building some new ideas together.
Yay.
All right. That concludes this week's episode of the Full and Thriving Podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this episode of the show. When you have a moment, please head on over to Instagram and follow my recovery coaching account at Meg_McCabe to stay up to date on everything I'm doing in recovery land. And if you're feeling extra inspired, please send me a direct message to let me know how this podcast has impacted your life. I'd love to hear your feedback. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next week.